the latest podcast in the My Imaginary University series, Eve Alcock, Head of Public Affairs at the Quality Assurance Agency, and Jim Dickinson, Associate Editor at Wonky, present their vision for a rather different kind of HE institution. This university, whilst definitely a campus operation, provides for students primarily on a short intensive block basis, thereby combining both residential and remote learning provision. It is a quite novel structure, therefore, which is intended to reinvent the way everyone looks at learning, but is very much in line with the current lifelong learning policy trajectory. The model also envisages strong industry links, community engagement, and applied learning, which ensures that, as Eve puts it, the employability stats are through the roof, although the leadership is so confident about their metrics, they really do not care very much for the rankings. The university is also a regulator's dream and are committed to supporting students within and alongside the curriculum. The university enjoys a unique co-leadership model where the Vice-Chancellor and the Student Union President work closely together on all the big decisions, and the Student Union is in charge of most non-academic expenditure. Furthermore, students are required to spend some time on committee work, credit rated as well, but any mandatory short online learning modules around free speech and the like are banned, as are old-style traditional lectures with no thought given to student engagement. It's a really positive vision for a very different kind of university with a new state of mind. Good times indeed. Welcome everyone to the latest exciting episode of My Imaginary University, and this time it's my enormous pleasure to have not one but two guests on the show. First of all, Eve Alcock, who is Head of Public Affairs at the Quality Assurance Agency. Hello, Eve.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
And secondly, but rarely secondly, is Jim Dickinson, who's Associate Editor at the notorious and famous international higher education site, which is Wonky. Hello, Jim.
Good afternoon, Paul.
And normally Jim's asking me questions, so this remains an exciting proposition. So, My Imaginary University, Jim and Eve have consulted for about 30 seconds and come up with a series of propositions around an exciting university which they are going to describe the background to. So let me throw it straight back to you, Jim and Eve. Give us the overview, the big picture about your jointly established university.
You kick us off, Jim.
Well, look, there are lots of universities that would say that they are fundamentally about their locality and commuter students. And there are lots of universities that kind of fundamentally have their soul in students going away from home at 18 and learning about life. And I think we take the view that this is a false dichotomy, number one. Number two, the residential experience is becoming harder to maintain in the context of a wider UK housing crisis that nobody seems to have a solution for. That even if universities were to take a large number of bed spaces in each big major city, that would look a bit selfish in the context of said housing crisis in the next 5 to 10 years as demand increases. But much more importantly, the concept of leaving home at 18 and not coming back has been conflated with educational tourism. In other words, we don't really value, and we kind of laugh at students who go back home after they've been to university, and that's nonsense if you look at the demography. Plus, it's really, really clear that people can have really rich experiences by having bursts of time at university. So, you know, when I did my master's, I spent weekends in London every couple of months on a block teaching model. And so our basic headline assumption is that for undergraduate teaching, the plate glass universities, as is one of those plate glass universities, just pick one from the 60s, has shifted its major home domiciled recruitment to a block teaching residential model where people spend 3 or 4 days a month on campus, in halls, having a really intensive experience, but then return to their community afterwards.
Mm. just right, can I just to unpack that a little bit? So they are from all over the UK and further afield, but principally the UK, it's hard to, well, you can fly in from Belgium, I guess, for 3 or 4 days, that's fine. Eurostar cycle. Anyway, they're but so they come in for short blocks, and they you use the residential accommodation that was traditionally used for you know, 3 terms for those blocks. Is there, and there are, yeah, it works, doesn't it? Right, because you have, if you right size your courses, then you have enough space for those blocks over the course of the course of the year. And and I mean, that's almost a kind of postgraduate business school model, isn't it?
Go on, Eve.
Yes, it is. And so it's not entirely new in that sense, but I think we, this university has sort of been forced to change its model to this because it needs to be new, deliver something interesting. It can't compete with the old and the traditional models of delivery. And also, I think as the sort of pilot of this in the institution goes on, we would hope that other institutions who have faced similar issues than ours would follow suit effectively. So we would show that we are a sort of viable model, a mode of delivery, very good outcomes, very good student experience, and that it could really, I guess, reinvent the way that people look at learning, not just in the sort of classic 18-year-old leaving school doing this mode, but actually lifelong. So we're you know, helping with the policy trajectory of lifelong learning too. We've thought of everything.
And so, and if you think about lots of professional development, this is of course what lots of people in their careers do. They go away on 3 to 4 day intensive residential training experiences and have a wonderful time nattering into the night, building really strong kind of social capital, having quite interesting kind of experiences, but then they return to their homes. And so that moral quandary I'm permanently in, being from the West Midlands, you know, is it great that I left home and I'm not going back to Walsall? Or is it terrible that that has happened and I'm evil for abandoning the West Midlands? This would not be a silly row anymore in my head, because I would have been able to successfully combine the benefits of both.
Yeah, we're the institution where you don't have to choose.
Excellent. Right. Okay. And so for the sake of argument, then you're essentially turning one of the existing 60s plate glass universities, or we're imagining that the Dickinson Alcock was created on that model 60 years ago, but as only just been noticed. So where would you want it to be? Would you want it to be in Walsall, right? Because, you know, Walsall is one of those university cold spots, isn't it?
Well, there's clearly, you know, I mean, there's nothing in some senses, there's nothing wrong with us saying to ourselves, look, as well as that kind of home domiciled group that we've, you know, really just experienced, there probably are still international students that are there all of the time. There's probably still a whole bunch of commuter students coming in from locally and from the region. The point is that the center of balance no longer is people who are there all of the time, because to some extent, and this is true talking to the 2 or 3 universities in the country that have gone down the block teaching model for undergraduates, it is clear that there are periods of time where it feels like everyone's there, and then there are periods of time where actually there's not a lot going on for those students, and that kind of, you know, so it makes some sense. Clearly what we have in mind is a group of universities that have struggled financially in recent years because of the expansion of the Russell Group. But, you know, that it's also clear, I think, that it is a model that you could put in all sorts of different places if you wanted to spread the economic benefits of participation in higher education. So, you know, I've said before, I'll say again, I don't mind number controls if the purpose of number controls are to spread the participation and the benefit around the country. I'm less of a fan of number controls overall to limit the overall exposure to the Treasury. But if the purpose is to move some students around where the economic benefits aren't currently being felt, then, you know, that sounds fine to me. And that would also help with that kind of regional thing and the commuter thing.
Okay. Let me ask you this then, right? So the model is distinctive, right? Although, you know, others are dabbling in it, but you're going for it wholesale, right? Is there anything, so structurally novel, right? Is there anything in terms of the subject mix, the curricula, that is different as well? Because, you know, some people will be attracted by the structure, but is there anything different that you're going to do, or is it just you know anthropology to zoology?
So I think the delivery of teaching in our institution will have a much higher focus on sort of place-based, industry-linked problem solving, the sort of really practical stuff that is supported by good industry links, that those students are there to effectively help with real-time problems in the vicinity that they're going for their residential like teaching blocks in. And therefore, the skills that people come out with are not just the theoretical ones, they're really applied, they're really based in work, and therefore our employability stats are going to be through the roof, basically.
And you know, I mean, the thing to say about that is that doesn't necessarily mean that students can kind of immerse in a subject and must be doing STEM or business studies. You know, we are also talking about, you know, students that are studying English literature that are engaging with, you know, reading groups and secondary schools and, you know, kind of community projects around the study of English literature. The point is that rather than a university that's kind of at the top of a hill where you escape and disappear for 3 years, actually what you're doing in those kind of intensive modules is deliberately engaging with the world, with business, and with the local community. And you know, arguably what you would want is, in order to build up your credits, you would have to have picked a selection of modules that very specifically caused you to engage with the community, you know, with business and with the world by the time you graduate.
Okay. So that's actually, you know, quite a different kind of student experience that, you know, is offered, you know, within and alongside the curriculum, which is, you know, I think you could reasonably argue is another novel selling point of the institution. Are there other aspects of the student experience then that, I mean, you mentioned that there might be, you know, quieter periods in the year or whatever. You mentioned that there might, you know, still be plenty of place for international students. But what's in terms of the, you know, the you'll have quite a lot of transients then in terms of the population that's on campus. So in terms of, you know, normal student expectations about, you know, societies, activities in the student union, et cetera, what does that actually mean for them?
That is a very good question. So in our institution, because of that transient nature of sort of in and out style, what we don't want is people to feel like they're sort of holding these different identities with their home lives on one hand and their sort of university lives on the other, that actually they're one and the same. And so we've got sort of wraparound student support in a kind of triangle around the student. So you've got an academic key point of contact to support on the academic parts of the course, much like a sort of personal tutor might in traditional universities. You've then got a dedicated pastoral contact to help with the links of how you're balancing everything, the kind of more student support side that professional services would typically do in a traditional institution. And then you'll also have a sort of dedicated career support mentor who is helping with how your education will eventually allow you to upskill, get good jobs, increase your prospects. And those three individuals are all communicating with each other and making sure that there's that kind of wraparound. And it means that a single person doesn't have to do all of those three things. So that is the sort of support triangle around the students at any one time. And our student union is geared up to support this model of transients too. So instead of your sort of classic year of freshers weeks where everything's all in, and then you never get any sort of like induction or whatever throughout the rest of the year. That is on a rolling cycle in the same way, and the sort of membership and engagement models that, that people can do are dip in, dip out, and they have a lot of, they're geared up really well to deliver that online delivery when the student is not physically based on the campus in that town and they're back at home, so that they are still able to engage regardless of where they're physically located, but the style of engagement suits where they are. So if they're on campus, there's lots of on-campus stuff, and if they're away back in their homes, there's lots of stuff that they can engage with online, so that they're still building that belonging, still building that community. It's just the mode of delivery is suited to their physical location at any one time.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, there is no doubt, Paul, that you know, if you assume that what a kind of undergraduate often does is build kind of social capital with people who share their kind of hobbies and interests, that will be harder in this model. But actually, the UK is really poor in comparison to the rest of Europe at building kind of academic capital out of students. You know, our subject associations are really weak in comparison to the rest of Europe. Yeah. And there's no doubt that if I am meeting up with everyone from my course for 5 days intensively, where I'll be up late at night, nattering away, doing quite intensive stuff in the community and so on, the subject stuff will be stronger. And if I'm supported by a central association that helps me book rooms and have a quiz on the Tuesday and so on, that's great. And of course, the other thing then about that is, a bit like running a cruise ship, there will also be, clearly, because there'll be loads of programs that have got their 4 days or their 5 days or whatever next week, there'll be opportunities to run really big activities. So, you know, when I think back to when I used to run the NUS training program, there were little groups that would, you know, hang out together for the whole week, but there would also be plenty of moments over the 4 or 5 days where we'd get large groups together to play rounders or to have a quiz or whatever that might be. So all of that becomes possible, even though what you're not able to do is have as your basic assumption everyone's there all the time. And as we know, the problem is right now everyone's not there all of the time. And so we're privileging the people who just so happen to be able to do that in a really problematic way. So this helps, I think, cause people to have to rethink lots of that stuff in a positive way.
Okay. No, that's really, really interesting. And I can get how that would work. And given that the students that you've recruited are, you know, up for this kind of novelty, you know, they are going to be enthusiastic about engaging in the way that you said, right? Because it's not that they're going into it without their eyes open, right? They've you know, explicitly and willingly and overtly signed up for this, right? So they you know, they will want to exploit what is on offer, won't they?
Just to say though, Paul, one other thing about this is, it doesn't, if you take a kind of traditional undergraduate program, so forget a kind of year in industry model or a Scottish model, just a 3 year, 180 credits sort of thing, 360 credits sort of thing. There are opportunities to do a full residential first year and then have people go off back home. Like this, you know, you can do all sorts of different things with this model where you perhaps might want a semester or an academic year that's very intensive, but then eases off on some of the other assumptions. And you know, we do have to be honest about this. There are a hell of a lot of students right now that we are saying are full time, that we are subconsciously expecting to engage as if they live close by, who are living really a very long way away because they're regionally commuting or they're international students that can't find family accommodation. So what we're doing is we're recognising reality and working with it rather than kind of crossing our fingers, pushing people through and hoping
it comes
along at some point to ease that model, because I don't think it will in the next 5 or 6 years because that housing crisis isn't going away.
But I get that, and I think, you know, this is a novel structural different approach at scale to addressing that, right? I think that the challenge comes when you want to introduce further variations within one institution to that model, because actually what you find out is that you're beaten by the physics of timetabling, right? And that you end up, you know, just trying to do too many things for too many different people because of their personal circumstances, and the system just can't cope with it, because, you know, that's the problem with mass provision, fundamentally. You know, they used to be able to get away with it in the old, you know, elite days. It was much easier in those days. Just did it on a little bit of pen and paper and wrote a letter to Johnny and told them to turn up. You know, that was it. Easy. Anyway, but I think it works, but you can't necessarily, you know, diversify too much until you, I would suggest, until, right, can I go back to one of these earlier points where you're smashing the graduate employment ratings, right? So this means, therefore, that you presumably have a very keen eye on the league tables, right? So you're worried about this stuff, are you?
Jim, I'm inclined to say that we don't care. Would you agree?
Well, look, do you know what? If you take that kind of access and participation John Blake thing where he says, don't think about the regulation, try and embed it so far in your brain that you're no longer thinking about pleasing the regulator, you're just brilliant at it. That's where we are. Like, we really want to. We're really passionate about students making a contribution to the world when they graduate. And we're so passionate about it and we're so good at it that our metrics are brilliant. But that doesn't mean there's a whole bunch of people panicking about the metrics all the time.
Yeah.
We're a regulator stream, Paul.
Right. So you're a regulator stream. So, yeah, you just do it instinctively. Yeah. But there will be people within the institution, right? And there may not be people that you want to get who will potentially care about rankings, right? And there will be, you know, sponsors and parents and partners who will look at these things as indicators of how whatever you're going to call your university, and I'd need to ask you that, is going to appear. But are you refusing to participate, or are you just saying, you know, we'll get what we deserve because we're great?
I want to refuse to participate, but that might not be the page that Jim's on. We're really good at them, but we also don't participate.
Yeah, it's not that we don't participate. It's that we have, you know, we are comfortable enough. We have a bit of a swagger about worrying about it because we already do so well on it. You know, that kind of comfort that a company's doing really well.
Yeah, so it's more of a Cambridge position that you're talking about in terms of the attitude.
Yeah, because our delivery model is so unique and so innovative and so groundbreaking, and our stats are so good that even people that come on an open day thinking that they care about league tables realize quickly that you can't compare us to the rest of the sector. Basically, we're that unique.
Okay, so it's actually more like the OU response, right? Is that we're different, we're special, we don't fit, you know, we're marvelous. So, you know, just forget about trying to measure this stuff. But by the way, 100% employment record.
The other thing, though, to say, Paul, about this is, if you think about the economics of our model, we're not saving money on academic staff or assessment or whatever, but my God, are we saving money on estates? Because we are sweating the asset of our spaces and our campuses in a way that no other university gets close to without asking academic staff to work over the summer, or, you know, some of those other models where, you know, you look at places like Buckingham and, you know, suddenly, you know, oh, where's my summer gone, all of that kind of stuff. So there are some extraordinary efficiencies in our model that allow us to really, really drive a fantastic immersive experience when people are there, and appropriate kinds of investment in, you know, staff capacity and permanent contracts and all of the other stuff that people are very worried about at the moment around the edges of the economic model, which are fraying. So, you know, ministers will be very interested in that. Mm. And we predict that we will get that kind of assumed protection from any regime that is designed to engineer out bad providers, whatever they look like, because people will be saying, oh, look, well, that works really well there.
Well, yeah, I'm absolutely sure you're right. Provided it, you know, it thrives and you recruit the students that some universities are failing to recruit, and you deliver on your promises, which are significant. So, are there I mean, you've got a lot of distinctive features you've described so far, but are there any other things that you need to set out? I mean, you know, your sporting offer, notable figures, chancellor, and, you know, name, and you know, mascots, and all that kind of nonsense. Is there other things associated with it that make it stand out even more?
So there's something incredibly unique about the leadership of our university. And that is, it is a co-leadership model between the Students' Union President and the Vice-Chancellor. So instead of the Vice-Chancellor leading the organisation and then the Students' Union President sort of at arm's length, either working with or arguing against or whatever, that healthy tension is brought into real sort of play by a kind of co-leading model. And it's the governing, there'll be a joint governing meeting between the governing bodies of the two organizations that are in charge of making sure that that relationship is a genuine healthy tension, that it works well, that the Vice Chancellor is clearly treating the SU President as an equal, that the SU President has as much say and veto over stuff that the Vice Chancellor does.
Ooh. Yes, you know that thing where university senior people, probably people like you, Paul, will occasionally from time to time say it's really important that we work in partnership with the Students' Union. We're actually making it true. So.
Well, no, I mean, that is certainly a distinctive and unique indeed approach. But I mean, in a sense, it's not a world away from the, you know, the kind of Scandinavian model of, you know, the Vice Chancellor meeting with the Students' Union every week to say these are the things we've got, you know, on the agenda. You know, you've got the opportunity to shoot them down, but it's actually making it real. It's not just a kind of here's some information, you know, aren't we kind? So I think that's really, I mean, really interesting.
One thing that really helps with this is, our base assumption in the UK is constantly that almost all of the spend on higher education goes through the funnel of the provider as the in our head, right?
Yeah.
But when both me and Eve have been around European universities, we constantly find differences to that assumption that are never surfaced when people talk about German free education or Swedish free education or whatever. And what we mean by that is, whether it's through individual student contributions in fees or whatever, or whether it's through direct central government funding, we would put the Students' Union in charge of almost everything that isn't teaching, research and knowledge exchange. And so really what you've got when the two meet is you've got the head of an organisation that is responsible for the wider student experience and student life with quite a lot of kind of infrastructure and so on around it. And then you've got the genuinely academic leader that isn't constantly burdened by also being a massive landlord and so on meeting. Mm. And you know, there are many ways in which not putting all of the kind of funding through a single kind of funnel of governance, we think would make lots and lots of sense. So it's not that the Students' Union President, as we currently imagine it, and the Vice Chancellor, as we currently imagine it, would be meeting. They would have different, subtly different roles in our model.
OK, well, no, I mean, it's imaginary.
But I mean, you know, to give you an example, Paul, right? So yeah. Belgium, I don't think many people know this. In Belgium, there's a separate budget line from government for accommodation, food, student services and so on. It has to be separately governed, and there have to be at least half of the people on that governance body that have to be students. And do you know what? When just a few months ago, when I was in Belgium, I was eating well and healthily and much more cheaply than I would in the UK, with far more students working behind the counter. Far more students were eating on campus and eating healthily. And those services felt more responsive than the kind of privatised model that most people have gone for in the UK. Now, there may well be more subsidy in there than is currently in the kind of UK system, but these are not that ridiculous. It's just that we don't tend to spot them, because the main thing we talk about when we talk about other countries is, are the tuition fees free or not? And it's like, well, there are loads of models out there that would feel outlandish, but are actually kind of working really well.
But the but the kind of underlying principle here is one where the, you know, the student body, the student representatives of the student body, the organizations of students are much more intimately and directly involved in the leadership, management, and indeed governance of the institution than has ever hitherto been the case in any other university in the UK. And does it work with a, you know, 1 year kind of president model? I mean, because turnover, it would be, I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing to develop a, you know, knowledge of the way the university works when you're, you know, when you are, if you like, just a normal student union president. This is a whole greater level of commitment and responsibility, isn't it?
Yes, though I think the sort of the pipeline of people being very involved in the students union to feel like they maybe want to take on that role in our institution is much stronger. Students at even lower levels of sort of student leadership within their communities are given more power and control and training and all of that kind of stuff, and so then the leap to becoming being in that role is sort of less than what we might traditionally think if a current students union, a traditional university president, wanted to jump up to that position, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay.
Yes. I mean, we should probably say, from a sort of mutual perspective, we would imagine there's a course rep on each course, but they're intimately involved in planning and curriculum development and so on. And that actually, between the Students' Union and the university, our target is that 75% of all students are on a board, a committee, or a project that runs something either for other students or the community, or a piece of CSR for industry. And that activity is part of the credit framework. So you can't graduate having not been on a board of two or three associations and served other students or the CSR of capitalism.
I was going to say, it sounds more like a disciplinary punishment. You know, you have to serve on a university committee.
But, you know, that kind of service learning thing, the King's thing, the service learning thing is so strong and so embedded and so expected that what happens is you flip the demand. So at the moment, lots of people are like, who on earth would come and serve on that? Who's got the time to do that? If you make it part of the credit framework, suddenly you cause people to think, blimey, how do I give away some responsibility while still keeping it safe, or whilst, you know, not running out of money and whatever? And I think, you know, if I got a load of registrars in a room, Paul, and said, imagine it was the law that next week you had to have, you know, 5,000 students each working in your, you know, whole operation, you know, you'd think, God, that's really hard. But eventually you'd sit round with some sheets of flip chart paper and some pens and you'd work out how that could work. And I think, you know, having that kind of incentive to, again, and this is again about sweating the asset, right? Universities are big operations with lots and lots of services and functions and so on. Really, on a charity model, hardly anyone is involved in the governance of that stuff. That's bad for society. And so if, when students graduate, they have been caused to understand the tensions of running things whilst also representing people and serving things, that's a brilliant way to sweat the asset educationally for the future of society.
Coming back to kind of contemporary issues, you know, a lot of talk about you know, council culture and things being banned in universities. Is there anything that you would ban in your fine new institution?
One of the things I think we would both say is the model of addressing things like free speech or sexual misconduct through throwing up an online module and hoping that students, you know, concentrate enough to, you know, stay on it would be banned. But a model that is principally peer delivered and that says one of the things you'll do early on, whether you're an international PGT for a few weeks or an undergraduate for a couple of months, is one of the things you'll learn early on very practically is how to interact with people that are not like you. And that will include free speech and sexual misconduct and so on, but not from the point of view of those kind of moral panics that surround harm, because both of those really are about debates about harm, but from the point of view of something positive, which is about learning how to interact with people that aren't like you. We pretend that that's what higher education does. It used to do it by accident. We'd be doing it on purpose.
Are you on board with that, Eve?
Yeah, sounds good to me. I also half wondered about a like traditional lectures where someone speaks at a cohort of students for an hour with some slides and no interaction or any sort of real world thinking is also banned. So basically, you just have to be like good at teaching.
What's your university song? Very, very, very important.
Jim's going to pick like some sort of rogue Eurovision song from 2 decades ago, aren't you, Jim?
No. You pick the song.
I'm going to pick Good Times by...
was it Chic?
Good Times! Chic? Yeah, Chic. That's the one. Yeah, Chic, Good Times is our university anthem.
Which encapsulates, without any undercurrent of drugs references whatsoever, the kind of spirit of the institution.
But just to say, in all seriousness, I am so sick of people talking about all the bad things that can happen to students and all the harms that students can come to and so on. And that's not to say that I'm not taking that seriously. But my God, when was the last time you heard someone espouse a really positive vision for the student experience that wasn't assuming that every student can have a kind of, you know, loads of money, rich on-campus residential experience? A positive vision for the student experience, you know, is where we're at. And Good Times is more than just, you know, trying to be positive in a sea of negativity. It is about recognising that, certainly for young people, it does look pretty bleak out there. And this idea that one of the things that you ought to be able to do as a young person and then cause young people to do when they're interacting with other people is think more positively about the future is really central to the ethos of the institution. It's about a better world. And if we can cause, therefore, the experience when they're on campus to be rich and exciting and diverse, but also really positive, you know, happy, then, you know, we are really into that, rather than constantly thinking about how you manage the next risk or harm that, you know, that rut we've got into in the UK.
I think that's it's a really valid point, Jim. I mean, you know, and it comes from the very, very top, you know, that negativity as well. But everything that anyone working in a university, you know, whatever role they're doing it, is trying to make the environment, the experience, everything that happens to students better than it was before, and to do something positive and enable something positive and create an environment in which students can make the most of the educational and social and other opportunities that are provided for them. Everything is geared towards that. And if you forget about that, yeah, you just run the risk of allowing people to, you know, to think that it's not about having fun and enjoying yourselves and growing and just having lots of new experiences. It's all terrible, right? And
yeah, it's all very, dodging very all of the terrible things that may or may not happen to you. Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, the analogue is for, you know, from the kind of fear of people moving from rural towns and villages to the big city. You know, it's that kind of thing, you know. So, you know, your assumption is that every corner you're going to get mugged or stabbed, you know, and it's you know, and of course it really isn't like that on the whole.
No. But of course, you know, in all seriousness, if OFS's proposals in England go through around harassment and sexual misconduct, it will be a requirement for universities to do that kind of, here's how you dodge a lot of harm, here's how you kind of stop other students from harming each other. It would be great if, rather than thinking, oh yeah, which online module can we throw at this problem to get OFS off our back, we instead said, let's get some students in a room who can design the first couple of weeks from a, here's what student life ought to be like and how do we get other students on board with that, you know, a really positive vision for the interaction between students and the interaction between students and the city, and also the interaction between students and academics. Yeah. Something positive would be fabulous, wouldn't it?
And I'm sure that your university will be offering such a framework. Well, let me say thank you very much indeed, Eve. Thank you, Jim, for presenting your very exciting, very progressive, very novel, distinctive, imaginary university, which, who knows, you may have the opportunity to make real one day if suitable premises become available in the greater West Midlands area. So thank you again. It's been a joy talking to you. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Eve.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
I do hope you enjoyed this edition of My Imaginary University. There should be more episodes along soon. In the meantime, you might like to listen to the equally higher education focused podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I talk to senior university leaders, most of them registrars or equivalent, about their careers and various bits of HE stuff. Just Google it to find many interesting episodes to listen to.